Welcome to The Mental Breakdown, where we tackle all issues related to mental health, mental illness, parenting, schooling, relationships, and everything in between. While Drs. Bernie and Richard will provide the most up-to-date ideas and perspectives, the information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for medical care. Our goal here at The Mental Breakdown is to provide you with information to help you make your life the best it can be. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bernie and Dr. Richard. Welcome to The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard. And before we start these podcasts, Dr. Bernie's going to explain to us why we're doing them, what we hope to accomplish, and where you can find them. Dr. Bernie?
Well, thank you. The idea of the podcast came from us talking over a long time. Dr. Richard and I have known each other for about 12 years, and what we have found is that there are many days that he and I will sit in the office and talk for hours about different topics and different issues that are facing us in our field, in the educational field, in the psychological field, in the medical field. And so what we thought was, why not put this out there for other people to hear and experience and perhaps to share their own insights with. So we started this podcast with the idea of just talking with you, sharing with you our insights and our thoughts about things, and to try to get some information out there so that you can be more informed and a little more understanding about things that are happening in our world. So with this first podcast, our idea was to really start with a fundamental issue in mental health care, and that is working to differentiate between mental health and mental illness. Now, Dr. Richard and I have worked in the mental health field for a long time, him much longer than I. What you can't see is that he's smiling. So we've been in this field for a long time, and what we have noticed is that for some reason, the mental health field is treated much different than any other field of medicine that we are aware of. So for example, you know, you think about our physical health, and people talk all the time about physical fitness, physical health, you know, we should exercise, what our typical body weight is, you know, how our heart works, how our pancreas works. We all are pretty familiar with how those parts of our body function. But for some reason, as soon as we get into the mental health domain, we completely change the way that we conceptualize our health. So when you think about physical health, you have a spectrum. You start out with somebody who is very healthy, the ideal body weight ratio of body fat to muscle mass, and that person is considered healthy. Now, there's very few people that, of course, fit into that category, but if we create a spectrum starting with that person or that ideal person and move it all the way to the right from very, very healthy to the far right being very, very unhealthy, there are a lot of degrees in between. And we think about that very easily with physical health. We think about people who have slightly elevated blood pressure. Their blood pressure isn't so high that they need medication, but it's high enough to say he has slightly elevated blood pressure. The same thing with diabetes, people who have some issues with their blood sugar. And what happens in the physical health world is we work across that spectrum from generally healthy until we get to a tipping point. And at that tipping point, then that person is considered unhealthy. And so that person then needs medication, or they need, you know, insulin for their diabetes or medication for their blood pressure. And for most of us to understand, that's a very clear process. Now, for some reason, however, we think very differently in the mental health realm. We think, for most people, when they think of mental health, they think of mental illness. Dr. Richard and I think very differently about that. We think that we should think about mental health in the same way that we think of physical health. So mental health would be the broad category. And we would start on the left with somebody that's very, very healthy, someone who's what we would call psychologically stable, someone with no real difficulties and with their mood or attentional capacity or anything like that. And then as we move to the right, we go all the way to the far right to severely mentally ill, a person who requires hospitalization, someone who cannot live independently. And again, in between, we have lots of different variants, lots of different degrees in between. And you can start at the very, very healthy person, maybe the ideal healthy person, and move to the right until you get to a tipping point, just like we talked about with physical health. Once you get to that tipping point, then a person who may be psychologically healthy becomes mentally ill, psychologically ill. Now, in between the very, very healthy person and the tipping point is also a lot of degrees of mentality. I'm sure that many of you listening to this podcast have had episodes of depression, but that doesn't mean that you suffered from major depressive disorder. Many of you have had difficulties concentrating and focusing at times, but that doesn't mean that you have ADHD. Some of you have maybe been sitting on your couch and thought that you heard something outside only to go out there and not see anything, but that doesn't mean that you were experiencing hallucinations or that you have schizophrenia. So we all experience mental health symptoms, but still fall within the mentally healthy range of functioning. Where that tipping point comes along is at the point of dysfunction. And so when we think about that, what we think of is a person, just like the person with diabetes who can no longer manage sugars in their diet without having problems, a person who's mentally ill across that tipping point begins to have functional problems in other aspects of their lives. So they may not be able to learn very well at school. They may not be able to function very well in their jobs. They may not be able to do very well in their social relationships. But because of their mental health symptoms, they are experiencing some level of functioning problems. So they are what we call dysfunctional. And in fact, when we look at our diagnostic system, the Bible that the American Psychiatric Association wrote for us called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, one of the main characteristics that must be present for any diagnosis to be made is an inability to function in at least one area of life.
And Dr. Burney, a couple of places where we see this play itself out, and I want you to talk a little bit more about this. We frequently see parents of teenage children, and the teenagers are acting like typical teenagers, being a little bit oppositional, breaking rules, challenging their parents. And parents frequently say, is this normal adolescent behavior, or should I be worried about an underlying mental illness? The other place we see it is with young children, 2 and 3 year olds, who are throwing temper tantrums. And parents will frequently ask us, well, is this just a normal temper tantrum, or should I be worried about a real loss of control? Is this an emotional meltdown? Those are the kinds of things we're talking about when we try to differentiate between mental illness and mental health. Because what we typically say to parents is, there's no impairment. The judgment that we make is this child impaired by this behavior? Would you speak to that a little bit more about what do we mean by impairment? How do we know that we're moving from a mental health issue to a mental illness issue? How do we know that?
That's a great question, and that is really where the art of medicine and psychology comes into play, because it's not always a very clear line. And sometimes, of course, what parents hate to hear is it takes time. Sometimes we have to look at what happens over time, especially with those young ones, where we have to look and see where they develop and where that trajectory takes them. Another way that we try to figure that out is in our clinical practice, we work really hard with those parents to provide them with strategies and ideas for managing the behavior. And what we find is that if you take the 3-year-old who's having severe temper tantrums, when you apply particular parenting techniques, the typical kid, the typical toddler, responds very well to those new parenting techniques, which moves us away from the idea of mental illness. Where we get into the idea or the concern about mental illness is when we're applying those principles, those ideas that we know are well-founded, and given the fact that the parents are utilizing those strategies as we talk to them about in the correct way.
So here you're talking about interventions, parenting strategies that parents typically use,
right,
and typically work.
Exactly.
For example, with a temper tantrum, we typically advise parents, just ignore it and it'll stop. What you're saying is, if you ignore it and it doesn't stop, maybe you're dealing with something else. And
exactly.
It's not just a normal temper tantrum.
Exactly. One of the examples that I often use when I'm working with patients in this kind of situation was actually from my own life. I remember my son, Connor, who you'll probably hear about a lot on this podcast because he's a great kid. I remember him being a young child and having a temper tantrum at Publix. And, you know, he gets upset, he's complaining that he wants a particular type of cereal. And I wasn't going to get that cereal for him. And he decided that he wanted to be upset about that. And so he decided to have a temper tantrum right there in, you know, aisle 7 of Publix. And so I had a choice at that point. And what I decided to do was really just walk away. I just walked down to the end of the aisle. And as I was turning the aisle, I looked back and he saw what I was doing. And he immediately got up and ran after me. And the temper tantrum was over. Now, he was upset that I was walking away, but it ended this temper tantrum. And so clearly, what Connor's behavior demonstrated is that he had some control over what he was doing. And when we think about dysfunction, true mental illness, we're talking about symptoms where the person really doesn't have control over it in that way. You know, we meet with parents a lot who describe their children as people who seek out an audience before which they display this temper tantrum, these rages, these outbursts.
They want to do it in front of somebody.
Right. They want somebody to see, right, witness this magnificence that is my temper tantrum.
Right.
Right. And when that happens, there's a certain level of behavioral control over those characteristics.
You're saying that the child has some control over what he or she is doing.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And so that, in my mind, typically, not always, but typically, that moves us out of the concerns of true mental illness and puts us into the realm of just behavioral decisions and behavioral actions of the child. Now, we have to be careful not to be too generalized about that because, you know, certainly there are kids who can demonstrate challenging behaviors in one setting but not in another setting. You know, I know that you and I both have had a lot of experience with that where children seem to do just fine at school, but they have horrible emotional regulation problems and behavioral management problems at home and with other family members and things like that, that do teeter over into the idea of mental illness. And it creates another interesting phenomenological perspective of mental illness. And that is, for some, if the consequences are dire enough, they're able to hold some control and hold those behaviors. The first time I experienced that was when I was an undergraduate at the University of South Florida, and I was working in the Tourette's syndrome lab at USF, University of South Florida. And we had a kid with Tourette's disorder there who the school had absolutely no idea that he had Tourette's disorder. He was able to work all day long at school, was able to hold back his symptoms, was able to not really demonstrate any tics at all. But when he got home at 3 o'clock, he let loose and his tics completely overwhelmed him and exhausted him to such that by 5 o'clock in the evening, he was so drained that he would go to bed at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and sleep the entire night. It just wore him out that much because it took so much emotional control, behavioral control to hold it throughout the day that when he let it out, it just exhausted him. And the poor kid, you know, he had to eat while he was ticking so badly so that he could eat dinner before he passed out in the 5 o'clock hour. So
that's a clear case where this boy that you're talking about with Tourette's, he was clearly impaired by his Tourette's.
Absolutely.
Okay, and that's what you're talking about when we talk about impairment.
Correct.
Okay, so that moves us to another dimension, another place,
right,
on this mental health, mental illness spectrum. Okay.
Right. And it's also a good indication that sometimes impairment is in some areas, but it's not in other areas.
Right. So you don't have to be completely impaired.
Right.
You might be impaired in academics, but not be impaired in social interactions.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. And we see that, for example, with learning disorders.
Right. Right.
A lot of kids have learning disorders. They have difficulty reading, but they interact well socially. They have good attention. Mm. They're able to manage their day-to-day lives, but they just have difficulty learning. And while that kind of puts us in a different realm of what is a mental illness, it does suggest some cognitive difficulties and things like that. So
just by way of review, so that we can sort of organize our thinking a little bit, what we're saying here is that with physical illness, we put physical illness on a spectrum from healthy to ill. And at some point, you cross some line, some imaginary boundary, call it a tipping point, where you go from being physically healthy to physically ill. Right. So the person with diabetes, you might have high blood sugar, but you don't have diabetes. You're not dependent on insulin. Your pancreas can still make enough insulin. But you're saying that at some point you reach a point where your pancreas can't, and then you have to take insulin.
Right.
Okay. But in mental health, do we make that distinction? Are we saying that we don't make that kind of a clear distinction with mental health?
I don't think that we've done a very good job at that. Okay. I think that that's something that, as professionals, we need to do better, because there are a lot of professionals and there are a lot of places that we go, resources that we seek that give us information. And that information is pathological, meaning that it seeks to give you a diagnosis. And, you know, some of Dr. Richard's early writing with me was about early onset bipolar disorder. And I remember early on, we would consume as much information as we could about bipolar disorder in children. And I remember this one particular book, which was considered the book to read for pediatric bipolar disorder. And it had several pages that had a list of all the symptoms that one would see in a child with bipolar disorder. They were all symptoms that I saw in my children, that Dr. Richard saw in his children, that everybody sees in their children, like wetting the bed, having a temper tantrum, resisting chores.
Liking sweets.
There's symptoms that we see in everybody. And, you know, unfortunately, sort of the double-edged sword of having so much information, access to so much information, is that we tend to over-pathologize symptoms and behaviors and characteristics. And so we are sort of looking for the opportunity to identify a mental illness, when really we may just be talking about variations of normal mental health before we get to that tipping point issue. Obviously, there are lots of consequences to that. Certainly, we will be talking in future podcasts about how we feel that a lot of things that are happening in our education system is contributing to the increased diagnoses of ADHD, for example. Do we think that many students truly have ADHD? Absolutely not. But are we creating environments and situations that create pathological symptoms that resemble ADHD? Absolutely. So we have to be cautious, and we have to do better, both as information consumers, but also as clinicians and professionals. We have to do a better job of differentiating what is normal mental health behaviors and symptoms and characteristics versus those that have crossed the tipping point and now enter into the realm of mental illness.
But one of the differences with physical health is that we have laboratory tests. We have laboratory tests for diabetes. We have pathology tests that we can say, yes, you have this disorder. Yes, your cholesterol is too high. Okay. We don't have anything like that in the mental health realm. We don't have any lab tests. For example, there's no lab test for ADHD.
Right.
There's no lab test for depression. So we can't say, yes, your numbers are too high, we have to put you on medication. So that's another important distinction between physical health and mental health. I think an important question for parents and for even adults who have these same questions is, how do we know when we've reached that point? Because we don't have any lab tests to know that.
That's a great question. And that's a great issue to bring up, because I think that as we have experienced over the years, that differentiation comes with good clinical skills. Dr. Richard and I were both fortunate, though in separate locations, both very fortunate to have received our clinical training by what we always lovingly refer to as old school thinkers. The psychiatrist I first worked with had his medical license in the 1940s, and what was fantastic about that is that Dr. Silver, he had the old school model of the most important thing is making sure that you have the right diagnosis, and then asking the all important question of why. And I think that a lot of times now what happens is a lot of clinicians look at symptoms and they just identify and label things based upon symptoms instead of asking that next question of why. And Richard, I think that you had a good experience with that with a neurologist, mm-hmm. where the neurologist, another old school neurologist,
right.
was complaining that a lot of today's neurologists, I think the quote was, couldn't identify a seizure if it was happening right in front of them, unless the person was connected to an EEG. And that's what a lot of our clinical skills have turned into. We piecemeal things together by looking at a symptom here and a symptom there and say, oh, well, if this two-year-old doesn't have a vocabulary at a certain level and isn't interacting with everybody in their environment, then they must have autism. And there's actually lots of other reasons why that may be the case. There's dozens of other variables that could be at play that would lead a child to present with those behaviors, but we throw developmental and psychopathological labels on some of these things, and we really don't consider too much about the consequences of what that will mean for the person or for our field later down the line. So it's a very interesting issue. It's a problem, I think, that we deal with dozens of times a week as we work with patients and do presentations and work with other professionals, the issue of how to actually use your clinical skills to make accurate diagnoses so that then your treatment will be correct.
But I want to go back to this issue of how do we make that decision in the mental health arena? How do we make the decision that I don't need to be concerned about this behavior, but I do need to be concerned if I see this behavior? There's no lab test. I can't draw blood. I can't do an X-ray. How do I know? Is it the issue of impairment? Is that what we're looking for?
You're right. I got a little off topic there, didn't I? Yes, the issue of impairment is of primary importance. We have to look at what consequences do the symptoms have on the child or adults functioning. We've been spending a lot of time talking about children, but mm-hmm. you know, certainly this is the same situation for adults. So we have to look at how the symptoms are affecting one's overall functioning in the different areas of the person's life. And when we see that it's causing an impairment, when we see that it's affecting the way in which they can interact with others, they can manage their daily lives, they can meet the expectations of their work, meet the expectations of their school, when we see impairments in those areas, that's when we need to start to have some concern. At that point, we need to implement interventions. The consequences of not having concrete, objective tests for some of these issues means that at some level, some judgment has to be made as it relates to what's going on and what's causing the person's symptoms. And so with that, unfortunately, comes a little bit of, for some clinicians, it's going to come down to almost a trial and error in trying to figure out, is it this? Is it anxiety? Or is it ADHD? Is it depression? Or is it remorse? And the way in which we make those decisions will be dependent upon our sources of information, where we're understanding, where we're learning things from, who we're talking to, and those kinds of factors. Whenever I meet with somebody, and Dr. Rich, I know you're the same way, especially whenever I meet with a child, the first thing that I want to do is get information from as many people as possible. You know, certainly it's the parents that bring the kid in, but I want to meet with the child, I want to meet with the mother, I want to meet with the father, I want to meet with any step parents, I want to talk with the teacher. I want to get information from as many sources as I can, and somewhat of a triangulation in trying to put all of the symptoms from different sources together to figure out what's going on. But it is a challenge. It is very difficult to figure out when a person has actually crossed that tipping point, and our biggest cue is the impairment in functioning. As soon as it becomes an impairment in functioning, I think that that's when we have to start thinking about a potential mental illness.
So what we're talking about here is when we begin to move toward mental illness, we're talking about specific symptoms that have to be met, as well as impairment. So the key issue here is you have the same symptoms, but you have to have impairment. So I saw two boys in my prior, they were brothers. And both of them met the criteria for ADHD. But in one of the boys, it didn't impair him in any way. He was right. able to go to school, he could function, he was a good student. He had all the symptoms, but they didn't impair him. His younger brother, on the other hand, had all the same symptoms, but they impaired him. They impaired his ability to go to school, to have social relationships. Right. And so we would say that the younger brother, how would we say that, had the disorder?
Right, right.
So, and he needed intervention.
Correct.
He needed, so the older brother didn't need to be on medication. The younger brother did need to be on medication. But the decisive factor was impairment.
Right.
Because without medication, the younger brother simply couldn't go to school. I mean, it was impossible for him to function in a regular classroom.
Right. And that's a fantastic example of that, because that is what differentiates variations in mental health from mentally healthy, generally mentally healthy, to having crossed that tipping point to having more problems and dysfunction and inability to meet one's daily needs.
You know, this whole discussion of mental illness being on a spectrum from being healthy, mentally healthy, to being completely dependent upon others also brings up issues related to public policy. And by public policy, I mean, how do policy makers determine when we've crossed that line and we need to be concerned? For example, the Virginia Tech shooting. The student who did that shooting was under the care of a psychiatrist. But how would the psychiatrist know that this person poses an imminent danger and would be capable of carrying out that act, or the two boys at Columbine, or the boy in the Newtown shootings? This is a question psychologists are frequently asked, is how do we know whether this student poses a danger to himself or a danger to others? And that seems to be an issue that is on this mental health spectrum. At what point do we know that this student poses a danger, this student doesn't pose a danger? How do we answer that question?
And that's a very, obviously, a very difficult question to answer. Because I certainly want to be clear about this, and you'll probably hear this a lot of times on our podcast, is that just because somebody's mentally ill doesn't mean that they're dangerous.
Right.
There are lots of people with severe mental illness mm-hmm. who are not dangerous in any way. So that...
Well, Dr. Byrne, but it's safe to say that most people with mental illness are not dangerous. That's a correct statement, right?
Right.
The overwhelming majority of people with mental illness pose no danger to themselves or others.
Right, correct? Okay. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about a subset within a subset. And one of the things that we're lucky to be able to do in our practice is we do a lot of work in forensics. So we are often involved in competency evaluations and assessments of risk for people. Over the years that I've been doing this, what I've found is that it's an incredibly difficult position to be in to say, yes, this person is at risk for being a danger to himself or others, or no, this person's not. There are so many factors that are involved. And I think that what we have to do, and you're absolutely right, this is a public policy issue, because at some point we have to have systems in place to be able to discover that. If we take the Virginia Tech situation in hand, very clearly, that person had some mental health concerns, some mental illness. He was being treated by a psychiatrist. He was experiencing distress. But there were no systems in place to provide the type of care that that person needed. If we take Columbine, you know, Columbine was obviously a travesty, but based upon lots of the information that's been out there, that was perhaps a travesty that could have been completely avoided with just a little bit more awareness. You know, those boys were involved in activities that nobody had any idea about, and there were warning signs that we saw afterwards that could have been observed, and I don't have any knowledge to suggest that either of those boys were really receiving any mental health treatment at all. So when it comes to situations like Columbine, certainly there are random acts of insanity that is unpredictable. You can't predict the unpredictable. But for a lot of our patients, for a lot of people that we know have some mental health concerns, again, kind of going back to the guy at Virginia Tech, we know that those problems exist. We need to have some systems in place that really is going to, those decisions are going to come from top down, government-wise, policy-wise, that provides some support and some care and some treatment support for these individuals. I think that, you know, certainly talking about those situations where someone caused harm to somebody else is important, but it's also important to think about people who cause harm to themselves. You know, there are certainly situations at universities and at schools where students are withdrawn or expelled or kicked out of schools simply because they're severely depressed and they may be suicidal and they may be experiencing those types of mental health concerns. And the school to reduce liability perhaps or to avoid having to deal with the problem, sending the student home or kicking them out of the school, which doesn't deal with the problem, it just in many cases exacerbates the problem by creating yet another stressor that's going to cause some impairment in the student.
I think suicide is probably a very good example of how difficult these decisions are to make, because if a student, I think as laws are currently written, if a student poses a threat to himself or herself, and there is a possibility of a suicide attempt, typically schools are we saying that schools are expelling those students? Do you get expelled if you're at high suicide risk?
At some schools, yes, they are being asked to leave the school, at least on a temporary basis, as like a probationary type of scenario.
Okay, so the problem is that we're taking these kids at risk, and the school is saying, we can't deal with this. Are there systems in place to put that child? Because if that child goes home and doesn't get any services, aren't we making things worse in a sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely, because...
And that's no services. Nothing's happening.
Nothing's happening. And the parents, you know, certainly depending on the age of the student, then the parents are left with, okay, so now what do we do?
Right.
This school, which seems to be or should be equipped to handle most of these things, are saying, we don't have anything to do about it. We don't know how to help this person. It's your problem. Sending them back to the parents, and the parents are left with no resources or few resources at the very best.
So in the case of the Virginia Tech killings, there really wasn't any place to put that young man anyplace. I mean, anyway, if he had been expelled from the university, or more recently, a young woman from Yale, was that today or yesterday or this week?
Yes, within the last few days.
Last few days, committed suicide. And because she had been expelled from the university.
Right.
Was she asked to leave the university?
She was, the reports that I've read suggest that she was placed on probation because she was experiencing some mental health concerns. And I think in her suicide note, she wrote that she wished that she would have been afforded the time to get stabilized on her new medications and to have the treatment that she needed. She seemed to recognize that she couldn't do it at school while she was coping with the demands of, certainly Yale is a demanding academic place, but she knew that she couldn't do it while maintaining a full schedule. But again, in her note, she wrote that she wished that she would have had the opportunity to get stabilized on her medications without the risk of either being expelled for or put on probation for a year, or maybe even not be able to return to the school at all.
I think that represents an excellent example of what we're talking about. This is a woman who, just because she committed suicide, succeeded in committing suicide, doesn't necessarily mean that she had a mental illness.
Right.
Correct?
Right.
Okay. But she was under pressure, college student, to perform at an elite university. She began to have suicidal ideation, suicidal thoughts. But there was no place for her to go.
Right.
There was no system in place to deal with her. Once the university knew that she was at risk for suicide, did they know that? Did they know she was at risk, or did they just know that she was depressed?
It's my understanding that she was receiving some treatment for depression. So she must have been experiencing some symptoms for a period of time. And again, there's a lot of news that's still coming out about the situation.
But that would be an interesting case of a woman who, did she or didn't she meet criteria for depression? If it was interfering with her schooling, it was interfering with her social life, it was interfering with her work.
Right.
Then we would say, yes, she was impaired by her depression.
Correct.
Okay, so we don't know. We just don't have enough information to know. But if she wasn't impaired, then we would say that it's a mental health issue, but there's no system in place to deal with her. The university is not equipped to deal with this, or
right. I think
don't want the liability.
That seems to be the primary issue, is the liability. Because in situations like that, and again, I hate to go too much into that particular situation because we don't know a lot of the details, but if you think about situations like that, because we have similar situations at private schools and grade schools that are private in our area, the issue is that if the school would have said, just as an example, I would be very interested to know what would have happened if the school would have said, you seem to be going through some challenging stuff, you know, receive the treatment, get the treatment that you need. When you're stabilized, there's always a place for you.
Right.
If the school would have responded that way, I think two things would happen. And this would be the case for the Yale situation as well as any other institution, whether it's an educational institution or it's an employment situation for an adult who's working. If there are policies that approach these issues in that way, it does two things. First, it lets the person know that their mental health is important and that receiving treatment and gaining that stability is vital. The second thing is, and this is something that's irreplaceable, and that is support. When a person feels, and we know this from research, it's very clearly documented, that when a person feels as though they have support, that there are resources for them, that when they need them, help is available. And that because they need help, they're not going to be cast aside, the person heals much faster. When the stress of being isolated or withdrawn or cast aside is present, a person has much more difficulty healing and feeling better. This is why, you know, a lot of people who are ill in the hospital, research has shown very well that if church congregations and people come up and sit with them and pray with them and do those kinds of things, those people will heal faster. Now, certainly that is attributed by some to the prayer itself, but a lot of that is also attributed to by just the social support of the people who are there saying, hey, we are here with you. When you are better, you are welcome back into our group. And I think that has effects that are almost immeasurable. When a person knows that they will be welcome back once they get through the struggles that they're experiencing, they are much more likely to succeed at getting through those issues.
So what this brings us to the whole issue of the stigma that's attached with mental illness versus physical illness.
Absolutely.
There's no stigma attached with physical illness.
Right.
It's like, oh, you can't help it, you're physically ill. We know that's not true because lifestyle contributes to physical illness.
Absolutely.
It's the same with mental illness. So we want to destigmatize mental illness by saying, it's okay, we all go through these things. I mean, 50% of Americans are going to experience symptoms of what we call mental illness sometime in their lives. So every other person you meet is going to experience these symptoms. Chances are, one out of two that you're going to experience them. So we get rid of the stigma.
Right.
And that's an important step to take. I have an even more complicated question that relates to this. Right now, the trial is going currently on for the Aurora, Colorado theater massacre. What would we say about him? People are asking, is he mentally ill? What do we say about that episode, that incident?
Well,
how does that fit into this discussion?
Well, I think that, and I don't know a lot about him. I haven't had the opportunity to read a lot about that person and his situation. But what I will say is that there are differences between people who are sociopathic and people who are what we're talking about as mentally ill.
Okay.
People who are sociopathic. sort of get off on hurting other people.
Right.
That is not necessarily a mental illness. That is, it's some other problem, certainly, but it's not something like depression or anxiety or even schizophrenia.
So when we see somebody like that, where there's just absolutely no explanation, no rational way of explaining what he did, that perhaps we're talking about sociopathy, and that question doesn't even apply when we're talking about mental health.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And we have certainly had lots of examples of people who are sociopathic.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Bundy, where was his impairment in functioning?
He really didn't have a diagnosis, did he?
No. He functioned very well.
That's true.
He did wonderfully. He was in school.
Finished law school.
He had lots of social connections and those kinds of things. Yet he does these atrocious, horrible things.
Mm-hmm.
He was sociopathic. He knew, and sort of the difference between sociopathic and psychopathic is the sociopathic understands the rules of social norms,
mm-hmm.
and intentionally violates them with the intent of gaining something reinforcing to themselves. The person that's psychopathic doesn't have that awareness, and so they are reacting and behaving based upon internal stimulation or internal drives that they sometimes are not in full control of. And so they kill people because the delusions tell them to kill people.
Voices in their head.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Or they're driven to it for some other reason.
Right, right.
Okay.
And we've certainly seen cases of those. I've had the fortunate opportunity to work on some of those kinds of forensic cases where,
mm-hmm.
you know, the person is driven by some psychotic delusion. And they believe that this person is evil or that God has sent them here to do something. And so that's motivating their behavior. And that is a very different person than a person who's sociopathic in nature.
So if we talk about public policy, whether we're talking about K-12 education, college and university education, or even the workplace, you know, people who come back, this concept of going postal, you know,
right.
where somebody returns to the workplace and does all that. So there are public policy ramifications of this concept of mental illness being on a spectrum.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And I think that what we're starting to see, and it's an interesting phenomenon to see how society is responding to these things. When you look at, there's a couple of areas of physical health where we see the same type of stigma that we see in mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Obesity. People who are obese are seen as people who behave that way because of their behaviors, of
right.
Volitional decisions that they're making. And we know that that's not the case, always. We know that that's not always the case. That there are many times when people reach obesity simply because of their genetic makeup, because of medical issues and things like that. Similarly, though, we see a lot of people see mental illness as volitional decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
We see this all the time with children, where, well, he's behaving that way because he's refusing to follow the rules. He's refusing to do this. He's refusing to do that.
Or making bad choices. He's just
right.
simply choosing to do this.
Right.
Okay.
And that puts us into a box that means that the children want to be bad. And you know, I've been doing this for a very long time. And I know that you've been doing this for a long time as well. Have you ever seen a child who wants to be bad?
Only one.
Only.
But we're talking
us,
about thousands, maybe
exactly.
tens of thousands of children that I've seen. Yeah, because we would see several thousand children a year. So yes, tens of thousands of children. I can only think of one who I think really wanted to be bad.
Exactly.
So.
And I think that's the case. For me as
the
well.
The others just can't help it, or they have poor impulse control,
right.
or they have high anxiety, or there's some other explanation for why they're doing the things that they're doing. I've never met a kid, except with possible one exception.
Right.
And I'm not sure that he's under full control of his emotions or behavior.
Right.
So even in his case, I'm not sure, but no, I've never met a kid who wants to be bad.
And I think that most people who work with children would say the same thing. By and large, children want to behave. If they could, they would.
Right.
And when they don't, for some reason, we kind of flip the switch to say, oh, well, he's doing it intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
He's And how many times have you heard parents say, well, he does it just to take me off? And
doesn't make me angry.
And that makes no rational sense, because when you say, well, what happens when he does that? Well, he gets a spanking, or well, he gets put in timeout, or he can't play his video games. And then you say, ask the parent, does he enjoy that? Oh, no, he hates that. Mm-hmm. He gets so upset when that happens, and he'll cry and cry. So if he doesn't appreciate or like the consequences, why would he intentionally perform the behavior that's going to lead to that consequence? It doesn't make intuitive sense. So we have to differentiate between can do and won't do. And when we talk about mental illness, we're getting into a problem of can't do. These are people who are behaving in particular ways or feeling particular ways because they can't feel another way or they can't behave in another way. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's where, from a therapeutic perspective, that's where we really have to focus.
Right. Well, that's, we feel very strongly. I think we agree very strongly, feel very strongly about that. That I think it's Ross Green who said, if children can, they will. Yeah. And so these are skill deficits. These are not just bad choices.
Right.
These are things that children would really like to be able to do, but they simply can't for one reason or another.
Right.
And that's a good perspective. And that does have implications for what do we do about it. And that's what parents want to know. What do we do about this?
Right.
What we don't want to do is punish children for something that they really are not able to do or not able to control.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And I think that as we are wrapping up this first podcast, which I really enjoyed, by the way, as we're wrapping this up, I think that it's important to end with hope.
Mm-hmm.
And the hope is that there is a return back across that tipping point.
By that, you mean that even if an individual, for some reason, crosses the tipping point, it doesn't mean that person is going to stay there.
Right.
There is the possibility of a return on the other side of the tipping point.
Absolutely. Okay. People we're never lost. Now, certainly those who have very serious mental illness, the path back is very difficult and sometimes impossible. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of people, they cross the tipping point and come back very, very quickly. And that's where treatment comes into play. That's where when a person is identified as having some difficulty, or they identify in themselves of having difficulty, and they seek the treatment and seek support that they need. Many times, very simple, basic strategies can be provided that helps them gain that functioning back so that they get back onto the healthy side of the tipping point. The issue is probably twofold. The first is, for some reason, and I can't quite explain it, and I certainly don't understand it, for some reason, though, many people feel that seeking help for these problems is a sign of weakness. I have to say, not just because I'm a psychologist, but because it just doesn't make intuitive sense, that we feel that identifying something in ourselves that we need help with is a sign of weakness. To me, that's signs of incredible insight and incredible understanding of oneself. If you can sit back and you can look at yourself and say, you know, I'm really struggling with these feelings right now. I need to go get some support from somebody who knows a little bit about this that can give me some strategies. That is a level of insight that suggests that your pathway back to the other side of the tipping point, you're already well on your way.
Right.
Those who don't see that they have those problems, those are the people who are much more difficult to treat because they're going to be resistant to treatment. They're going to be avoidant of finding that support and help that they need. And they're much more difficult to manage. So the first thing there is recognizing that when you see yourselves as being in need, you know, getting the help that you need is critical. You know, overcoming that strange perspective that, oh, if I need help, I must be weak, because that certainly isn't the case. The second part is, of course, finding the help that you need. And, you know, there are lots of mental health professionals out there, lots of people who do this kind of work. And so finding the right person who either specializes in what it is that you're concerned with or that you're experiencing a problem with, or finding somebody who you can connect to that's going to be able to provide you the support that you need. There are a lot of us, and Dr. Richard and I certainly consider ourselves generalists when it comes to a lot of this stuff, because we try to keep ourselves educated on as many things as possible from infancy through adult so that we can help as many people as we can. But there are certainly those who specialize very specifically in OCD or depression or childhood issues and things like that. So either you find somebody who specializes in what you're looking for, or you have to overcome the stigma that we were talking about earlier and talk to other people. Who to have other people talk to? I always love it when patients come in and I say, well, how did you find out about us? And they say, well, I was talking to my friend and they said that you were helpful for their situation. Because what that means to me is that that person isn't afraid to talk about what's going on with them. They recognize that they have these difficulties and they're seeking support not only from me but also from their social systems and things like that. And again, that puts you well on your path of recovery and back to being on that healthy side of the tipping point.
So in that sense, you're saying we're not going to make you normal. You know, people say, well, will I be normal? Normal's not the right word.
Right.
What we're saying is you've reached the tipping point, you're on the other side. All you want to do now is get back to the other side of the tipping point.
Back to where you can function.
Right. It has nothing to do with normal. You know, you're already normal no matter which side you're on.
Right.
Okay. All we want to do is get you to this other side so that you can function better.
Right. Okay. Good. Yeah, I never really understood what the word normal means.
Right. Normal has no place in the discussion, I guess.
Right. All right. Well, I think that is where we're going to wrap up our first podcast. Thank you all for listening, and we hope that you download our podcast. We're available on iTunes, but you can also check us out at our website at www.pacflorida.com or on our blog at thementalbreakdown.com. So I'm Dr. Bernie.
I'm Dr. Richard.
And we will look forward to talking with you next time.
Thank you for listening to The Mental Breakdown. If you want more information, you can check out our website at www.pacflorida.com. All of our podcasts are available for download on iTunes, and you can follow us on our YouTube channel and on Facebook. We would love to hear from you, so feel free to send us messages either through the website or on Facebook. You can also send us questions or topics you would like for us to address on future podcasts. Drs. Bernie and Richard are available for workshops, so contact us for more information. Thank you again for listening, and until next time, stay mentally healthy.